This is the beginning of class 3.
Sashi Bhagi Jushin Eto Jam Vira Vinci Nyende Kempadi Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogunanda Shingla Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodama Chanchu Badu Dagni Kyasu Chi Dagi Chunyen Dibbe Sunangi Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodan Sangye Chodama Jubadu dami kasuchi Dagi chumyen dipe sunangi Jola penche sangye jubasho Sangye chudan sangye chudama Jubadu dami Suchi Dahi Chunyen Gimbe Sunamki Yola Penche Sange Jubashu
Yamsha, alright, sorry. And everyone who didn't answer was right. Namshak is the sixth kind of meditation. We talked about six different kinds of meditation, six different words for meditation. And Namshak means, it usually refers to meditation on emptiness directly. And it's as opposed to Jetop, which means that's the meditation that you're, that's what's happening when you come out of meditation on emptiness directly. Oh, Unze wants to do it. We usually do a Daki Jinsok. You have to change that. Before a class, you don't say Daki Jinsok. In general, you say Daki Jinsok. But before a class, you say Daki Chunyin. Chunyin. So the Daki is the same, but you replace the Jinsok with Chunyin. Instead of praying that all your general good deeds help people, this refers to the six perfections, you're praying that by the act of your coming to this class, you should be able to help people. So that's Chunyin. Chunyin means to listen to the Dharma. Okay? Chun means Dharma, Nyin means listen. And I have to say Chishe, which means the act of explaining Dharma. So I say Chishe, don't get worried. You say Chunyin. And Jinsok is what you do in general in your morning practice. Okay, so we were talking about Nyamshak. Nyamshak means the period when you're in direct meditation on emptiness. It happens for the first time when?
When you experience Shunyata.
Yeah, which is? Directly, talking directly.
Directly.
Path of seeing. The path of seeing. Don't worry about it. These are for the old students. There's a path called the path of seeing, mental space. And at that time, you enter Nyamshak on emptiness directly. You enter this kind of meditation on emptiness directly.
The path of seeing?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And when you come out of it, you enter a state called Jetop. And that's, you're out of deep meditation. And you're having these realizations, including what?
Four Noble Truths.
Four Noble Truths. That's... The word noble is, as we said before, the wrong translation of the word kappa, which means at that point you become a realized type of being. And those are called realized truths, arya. So Yamcha is as opposed to Jeto. Jeto is when you're seeing the Four Noble Truths, thinking about the Four Noble Truths. Oh, this is suffering. This is this. You actually realize them directly for the first time in ever. But Yamshak occurs right before that, and that's when you're actually in deep meditation on emptiness. And that's the classic example of Yamshak.
How is that different than another of these meditations?
Well, they all overlap and they're all fuzzy, and I'm giving you the major sense. You notice I said general sense and I didn't say definition because they all overlap.
So really that could be like a part of
Myeomjeok
when you're seeing.
It is a kind of gomba. It is a ting and zin. It's also a shine, shamatha. Okay?
Well, that's clear.
It's not a myeomjeok. It's not one of the classic myeomjeoks. Okay, so I just want you to get a sense of these are the main places. It's also a shine, shamatha. Okay?
Well, that's clear.
It's not one of the classic myeomjeoks. Okay, so I just want you to get a sense of these are the main places. It's used in another case in the Heart Sutra. It says, The Buddha enters Yamshak. And the whole Heart Sutra, the Buddha doesn't say anything except at the end. He says, oh, you guys did a good job. And the whole sutra is one of his students speaking to another of his students because he's in Yamshak and he's affecting their minds. They're like puppets, and he's making them ask each other questions. So that's Nyamshak. Those are the two classic examples. So if I ask you what's Nyamshak, you should say direct perception of emptiness, as opposed to Jetov, which is after you come out of that deep meditation and you start getting these popcorn, you know, ding, 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 I understand that, I understand that, I understand that.
Michael?
Yeah?
You only use Jetov after the initial direct perception of emptiness. No, but you had made a distinction about the perception of the Four Noble Truths coming out of emptiness meditation as being something that happens when you first see emptiness directly. This is not something that repeats itself every time you do emptiness meditation.
No, it does. Yamshak means any direct meditation on emptiness.
No, I know. I said
and
J-top.
So does J-top. Yeah. J-top is any time you come out.
Come out. So it's not just the Four Noble.
It's not just the
any
first
kind
time
of realizations.
Yeah.
Can you write J-top?
Yeah, okay, you asked for it.
Is that a meditation? It's not a meditation.
It's actually a state of contemplation, perhaps, something like that. It's no longer conceptual. It's no longer non-discursive thought.
It is discursive thought.
It is. This is this. This is that. Oh, this is this. This is that. It's exactly that. It's not like when you're perceiving emptiness and it's just like they call water poured in water.
Discursive thought about what you've seen in emptiness.
You're thinking, I saw emptiness. J-top. Most of the paths have these two stages in them, the higher paths. But don't worry about it. If you haven't had it before, it's okay. It's not on the quiz, nothing. I felt guilty because I left that out and everybody had trouble on homework.
After
I
you
did that last time and everybody called me up on the phone.
So this would be after you see the four Arya Truths? Then J-Tope?
You are in J-Tope when you are seeing the four Arya Truths. J-Tope means what you get afterwards. J means afterwards and Tope means get. Alright? Okay, now actually we'll go on to the lesson. All right, squeeze, squeeze. All right.
Over here.
Which one did you get?
All
right. So tonight we're going to talk about what was it? We've had two classes. The first two were about how to get ready for a meditation.
Preparation.
Preparing for a meditation. And what did I promise you the second thing would be?
Conditions.
Yeah, the environment in which you meditate. We didn't get yet to how to meditate, and we won't for a while, because the reason most people fail is that they don't do the stuff before the meditation to make the meditation go well, and we're going to see that tonight. He's going to actually say that. So the environment breaks down into six conditions. We call them the six conditions. As I said before, Tibetan Buddhism in general loves the three thises, the four thats, the five thats. It's actually a very good method. Mao Zedong used it in his little red book, if you ever read it. who's responsible for the best law. I read it so you know the person's mind, you know, and he was very good at it. He's obviously a great propagandist, and so it's very helpful to remember things if you say the three dads, the four dads, the five dads. So we're going to have six conditions. Okay? The first condition is, now we're talking environment, right?
Is all of this out of Lungren Chimo still?
Yeah, it's a good question because I'm going to be telling you where all these things come from. In general, it's the Lungren Chimo of Tsongkhapa. But as you know, Tsongkhapa was a great plagiarist. And it's considered good Buddhist writing if you're a plagiarist because the people you're stealing from are enlightened beings. So why write anything new? You just cop things from other sutras and put them in a new order for the new generation, but you don't write anything new. And that's fine. In fact, it's considered a fault if you try to stick in your own ideas. So this is Jetsun Kapa relying on several other books, and we'll talk about it. Several classic books from ancient India. Okay, so Tumba means, I think we talked about it last time, Tumba means when two people get along, harmony. So Tumba means conducive. And Yul means place.
And like
those
dogs. I don't know. Also mean like land or country?
Yeah, Yul generally means country. And you don't have to know that. Generally in philosophy it's a very important word meaning object of the mind. But we won't look at it. Tsongkhapa takes his description of a conducive place to meditate from the following Buddha. Say Dodegen. The Sanskrit name is Sutra Alamkara. We talked about this before because we had the Abhisamaya Alamkara. Alamkara is a Sanskrit word that means get ready for something. Alam means get ready and kara means to get. And when a princess in India went to a ball, she would alamkara her. She would put her jewelry on. So alamkara means a jewel, in the sense of jewelry. And sutra means any open teaching of the Buddha spoken by a Buddha. So it's the jewel of the sutras. And it's written by, it's not a sutra, it's a commentary on sutras. And it's written by, who wrote the other ones, the other Alamkara? Do you remember?
What was it? What was that one called?
The Abhisamma Alamkara. Jewel of Realization. Ornament of Realization.
Karibabu?
He wrote the commentary. Good. Not bad. Asanga. Okay. You have to know Asanga, all right? Asanga lived when? You guys know.
About
350? Yeah. About 350 AD. I told you this story before. His mother was a nun. She had a vision that if she... Buddhism was declining in her era, and she had a vision that if she gave up her vows and married a king, that they would have a child, and that if she then married another, a Brahmin, they would have a child, and that those two sons would become the two greatest scholars almost of all time, next to the other. So one of her sons was a Sangha. And between him and his brother, they wrote every single book that's used in the monastic curriculum, except for, I mean, they wrote two of the great five books are by those two brothers. So they're responsible for just about, you study the first book for 12 years. You study the second book for about 3 years. So that's, they wrote the most important. So Sangha has written this book also, Sutra Alamkara. And in that book, he explains what's a good place to meditate. So, yes.
Jewel ornament of realizations?
Jewel
ornament.
You can call it jewel ornament. Some people call it jewel ornament, some people call it ornament, some people call it jewel. something of realization. Of realization. This is not that. This is the jewel of the sutras. So he wrote two jewels.
This one is the jewel of the sutras.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about those guys studied the other jewel in this course, for the whole course.
How do you get jewel out of this? I thought you said it was to get ready for a sutra.
Yeah, get ready means...
Put on your jewels.
Put on your jewels. Oh. So the word get ready became the word for jewels in Sanskrit. Alankara became the word for jewel because it's what you put on to get ready. For a ball. So Dodegyan. In there, he says a good place to meditate should have five characteristics. It's the book from which Tsongkhapa has taken the description of a good place to meditate, a conducive place to meditate.
When we say in the book, this list, are you talking about both books or?
It's actually three or four. It's a stream, and I.
Well, what should we refer to it as?
If I ask you who described, and I'm going to ask you, the conducive place to meditate, you're going to answer. Sangha described it 350 AD in his Jewel of the Sutra.
Now, is this Jason Kappa's commentary, though, or is
yeah,
this a Sangha?
Tsongkhapa is quoting him. Tsongkhapa is explaining what a Sangha said, because if you go and try to read a Sangha, forget it.
And this is just Jason Kappa in Lam Rinpoche Mo
explaining
Sangha in that.
Which is like, Buddhism is like an onion. Yeah. I mean, Buddhist learning is like an onion, and you get deeper and deeper. You get closer and closer to the middle the longer you study. So, the first point, and it's in your reading, is that you should have all the necessities you need. It should be easy to get food, clothing, in other words, everything you need physically should be there. Now he's mainly talking about an extended retreat in which you're trying to develop shamatha purposely, which you can do in like 6 months if you really...
Shamatha?
Yeah, shamatha meaning what I've translated here as quietude, which you had in your first homework as that very, very high state of meditation with which you see emptiness. Quietude. Excuse me?
King of Samadhi?
King of all concentrations. So anyway, this is mostly referring to a real heavy-duty retreat that you do. The place where you do it, you should have everything you need.
You mean you shouldn't ever have to leave to get things? Is that what you mean?
Well, that's one meaning of it, but you shouldn't have to think about anything else.
Like, oh, there's no electricity.
Food should be set up for you. People tend to think, you know, when the Buddhism first came to America, I don't know if you knew Alex Matikov. He heard about Milarepa, but he went out in the forest next to our house. And he got cold and came back after 2 days. I mean, it doesn't work. You have to be comfortable. It's very smart to go to get a place, make sure it's nice, and it should be comfortable. And everything you need is there. You have someone cooking for you. It's very bad if you have to cook your own food. Someone else should be cooking. Because otherwise, you're going to think, what should I cook tonight? You know, I have to cook for this. Maybe I should put... You start meditating on what you'd like to eat tonight. It's very bad. Someone else should be cooking. You should have no contact with him. In New Jersey, we've done it. Tom did a good meditation. They put it under your door or something. You don't know what you're going to get, so you don't worry about it. And that's better. And you should have enough clothes. Take enough clothes. They should be clean. You don't have to be all dirty. Paboka in his meditation manual says, I don't like this thing about monks in retreats so they can have a beard after 3 weeks. No, you have to be clean and shave. Be normal. Be comfortable. That's the idea. Your meditation is a lot better because you're not meditating on how much a bigger yogi you are. You're not meditating on trying to stay warm when it's cold. And it's very important to be comfortable. So that was the first thing that a Sangha said 1600 years ago. The second thing is that it should be a safe place. And Tsongkhapa explains that to mean there shouldn't be any wild animals around that could hurt you. This refers to people in India or Tibet who would go up in the mountains Or if you know Yeshe Dumbin, who was here last week, he spends most of the year up in K above Dharamsala. And it's a problem. I've had bears and stuff. It's a little scary. You shouldn't have. It very much interrupts your mental. I had a skunk one time here.
Oh, man.
It's very bad. So it should be a place where you're not threatened in any way. And they also say bad people, that you shouldn't have any place where you have an enemy or someone who doesn't like you. Any kind of a threat to you. Or it should be a comfortable place, a safe place.
What's the word for that safe place?
I can give it to you if you like, but it's in your reading.
Okay.
And the verse is very cryptic, like all the ancient verses were. They were meant to be memorized by the student maybe 10 years before he knew what it meant, and they still do that in the monastery. And then the function, the role of the teacher is to tell you, hey, this is what that means. Then he says you should have a good environment, and he explains that as meaning. It should be a place where you don't get sick. There's places like the first monks that came out of Tibet in 1959 were meditating in a place called Baksa. And it was in the jungle in West Bengal. And it was just a lousy place to be. Almost, I'd say maybe a third of them got tuberculosis there. It was very damp, very hot. They didn't have enough nutrition. Their lungs were expanded from Tibet. And most of them got sick. So it should be a place where you're not going to get sick. Shouldn't be too cold, shouldn't be too hot. The temperature should be just right. When you're meditating, it's very important that the temperature is just right. If it's too warm, you start to nod out. If it's too cold, you get distracted.
So now in the sense of a long retreat, you know, you're going to go through seasons, for example. Would that mean try to find some place where you're not going to have heavy snow or hot winter?
Well,
hot summer,
where inside is not going to...
So
don't be shy to get a place with central heating.
Or air or whatever.
I did a retreat in Arizona one time. The weather changed 40 degrees. It was too hot in the afternoon, and by night it was snowing in the desert. And it was distracting. It got very cold. So, you got to find a place where the weather's... But you also have to make sure that whatever it is that you use doesn't make noise.
The heater and stuff?
Yeah, like if a fire is very distracting, a heater that goes click, click, any noise, after you've been in retreat for about a month, a mouse can be a disaster, and they are. So you have to find, just don't be shy to find a normal house in a normal place, away from sound as much as you can. I think a refrigerator can be a disaster. I found it there. If you've done a retreat for about a month, it starts to sound like a truck. And then you go and unplug everything in the house before you sit down. It's very distracting. So very important that you don't have any noises. And in your daily practice, we're talking 15 minutes, half an hour. The good thing about doing it is early in the morning or as you can, which I find better than late at night, but I saw in your papers a lot of you, maybe you just don't have time till late at night. Late at night is good, and we'll see it later, in that it's quiet. At least in general, it's more quiet in the early morning than late at night. Because sound, it's very famous. In all the scriptures, it says that sound is the worst distraction. Sound is very bad when you're trying to meditate. Hmm.
No squirrels digging into the roof.
We have squirrels. Okay. Number four is, he calls it good friends. And it's that whoever's assisting you in the retreat should be a person who has faith in the Dharma. And he shares your values. He has good morality. And he believes in the Buddhist worldview, which, mostly emptiness. Should be a person like that. If you've ever had a person... If you're in retreat, and because you don't have any choice, you have someone coming to help you, you have to have a retreat assistant. You may never see him during the retreat. It's better if you don't. But it should be a person who's mentally in tune with you, because you'll sense it and you'll feel it. And it's better if all the people around the retreat are intimate. And the same in wherever you're going to meditate. If you try to meditate in a place where people don't appreciate it or people don't like it, it's very hard to concentrate. It's just the way it is. So that's all coming under These are all still under this. I'm not going to ask you to label all five. If you remember some, it's fine. The fifth one he gives is, he says it should have goodness. The verse says, all the verse says is have goodness, and it says in the day there should not be too many people around, and at night there should not be much sound. So it just means that there shouldn't be distractions, people or sounds. When you do a good meditation, a retreat, don't waste your time. It's hard to get the time in your whole life to do a 1 month retreat or a 2 week retreat. And don't waste your time. Set up everything very, very intelligently, you know, based on this. And talk to people who've done long retreats before. And they have, after you do one, it's good to make a list of all the things that you did wrong. And then the next time you do it, you know what you need. Like chapstick is very important. Incense is very important. You know, you get a list of things that are very important, and you learn more about it every time you do one. So talk to people who have done long retreats before, and don't screw up the opportunity, because once you get into the retreat and close the door, you're not supposed to go out for a month or something. And if you figure out that you forgot something, you have to start writing notes, and then that's a distraction. Better if you don't see anyone. You know, close the windows, tape up, put something over the windows.
How long should one go into a retreat?
I think in our tradition, I mean, there are three-year retreats, there are 3 month retreats, 3 year, 3 months, 3 days, 3 days, 3 months. But I think if you, for example, if you take that initiation this summer, or if you've had that initiation, you will be required to do a certain number of retreats. And they last between 4 and 5 weeks. And they're very great. Because once you take the initiation, you swear to do it. And I know I worked for 10 years, I didn't have time to do anything. I was exhausted every day, and I didn't do any retreats. And then I got on a different schedule, and I was able to do them again. And it's a very good, it's good to be forced to do one. Because otherwise you'll just go on and never do one. And it's very important to do them. They change you dramatically. So it's very, then especially those retreats, which you have, there are books on how to do it, the training, everything, and they're wonderful. They come out really good. And they're not what you expect. What you're supposed to do is not what you expect. And it works. It's very nice. I think Kylie did, how many did you do? 1, 2? It's one of the Shirama's stuff. And other people. They're very good. If you do it right, it's very nice. And if you do it wrong, you can crack up, and people do that. So you have to study how to do it properly. And then you won't have any trouble. It'll be quite pleasant.
Do these pertain to group retreats also?
I've been in group retreats. We don't emphasize that, but I think some people have said they might like to do a group retreat. I think it might be distracting, but then again, they say if you meditate in a group, sometimes the power of the unity of all the minds and all the people is very, very good. So I think, I think they would also apply. But obviously you're going to see other people in the group retreat. Good not to talk with anybody. You shouldn't see anybody, you shouldn't talk to anybody. It's better if you can.
The fifth one again, Michael?
He said, what was it?
Goodness.
Having goodness in a sense, and he lists only two things. During the day, there shouldn't be a lot of people around, and there should be no sound. Voice sounds.
So,
it has nothing to do with goodness, but...
Has nothing to do with, like, if the Lama meditated there before.
No. It's a very difficult verse, and Tsongkhapa is explaining it.
So when you say cover the windows, you mean you shouldn't really even be able to see what's outside the window? Is that what you mean?
No, like where I used to go, Mount something? There's a beautiful snow mountain at the back. So I would leave a little strip across the top of the window. But what I mean is you shouldn't be able to see any living beings.
But
squirrels,
like,
dogs, people.
No movement, no activity?
Yeah. Tape it up, you know, to the top of the window if you can. Or I'd like to use these white curtains, these, what do you call them?
Shades.
Yeah, the inside of a curtain.
Shades.
Yeah. And then light, you can get the light and you don't have to see anybody. And then the light is very nice. It's very helpful sometimes when you're meditating.
So looking at the scenery is okay or no?
It's okay. But if you are on, if you're below 6 feet, you're going to see somebody if they run by. So, I mean...
Saying like if you're out in the middle of nowhere,
yeah,
in
that's
the desert.
Right.
You know,
that's all right, but in, I've been there, and there's all sorts of things.
Right. Why,
hard to find
why can't you see an animal?
It's very distracting. It's just very distracting. You should be in complete solitude, and it's better. It's really better. Because what it does, it forces you. Also, you should, we'll get to it, but you, and don't write it down, but you should have no other activity. You know, I used to try to memorize some text while I was in the tree, or do anything else. You should have nothing else. And then what happens is you get, what do you call it?
Stir crazy.
No, I mean, you get, the isolation drives you into your mind.
Yeah.
And you get good results.
Stir.
And if you have anything else to do, your mind will grasp onto it and distract you. You know, if you have to do anything else, your mind will grab onto it because it's lonely. And it'll distract you. And it's important to drive yourself into this isolation when you're just forced to live in your mind. And then you can develop some good meditation. And it's new. You've never had a day or more than a few days when you weren't talking, for example. And that's hard. All that energy gets driven in and you have good meditation.
So if you're doing a month or a 3 month or a 6 month retreat, you're not supposed to like go out and walk around outside or zip it. Oh my God.
True.
6 months, you're like not going outside, not walking.
I mean, a true retreat, yeah. It's important to have enough place I've found to walk around inside, because that's just in case you get. There's a thing called loom, which is like psychic energy, which builds up, and if you start to have a problem, it can cause a big problem. You know, you won't sleep for a few days, and then you have to break the retreat and go to the hospital, and they shoot you up with something and you sleep. That's very common for people who don't know how to do retreat properly to get loom, and very common for people to experience bad disorder, like, you know, serious things where they can't sleep for a week, and then they have to break the retreat. So it's very important to do it right, and food is very important to eat very well. I know Goenka, who's a great meditation master from Burma, who the Dalai Lama sent to the monasteries to teach us. He would feed you well, you know, royally. And it's important you eat well. If you don't eat well, if you eat a lot of sugar or starches or coffee, Coca-Cola once almost made me crazy, and ice cream. You can't have any of that stuff because it will hurt your winds and you can go crazy. So you have to eat very oily foods, very heavy foods. They keep you down.
Grounded.
Yeah.
Mike, what about taking your offerings out at the end of the day? Is that something that you should have your assistant do for you? You shouldn't even go out to do that.
No, the line, normally the line of the retreat is the door threshold. And you seal the door. Someone else take them. I would put them in a garbage bag, and I had a neutral territory like a foyer, you know, put them out there. I close my door, it comes, you know, it's good. You shouldn't see anybody. It'll just drive you into yourself, and meditation will be great. Okay.
What about sleep?
It's very important to sleep well. And later I'll teach you, we can't do it in this class, but there are instructions about that, special instructions about that. So if you ever do a retreat, we'll talk about it. But in general, you shouldn't try to be a hero. You know, you should sleep. There are periods for sleep that are different, but in general, you get a good sleep. A good 8 hours is very nice when you're meditating. Enough sleep is very important when you're meditating. Any extreme action is going to make you nuts. You have to just be normal. Good eating, good happy thinking. By the way, no music. That's a disaster. No TV, obviously. No radio. No books. No magazines. No newspapers. No personal letters. Those are all a disaster.
No Dharma books, no.
Dharma book, if you're getting loom. And you see, that also becomes a distraction. It becomes an excuse to not think and not be inside your mind. And you'll find that you're craving it, you know. And it's not because you want to study Dharma. It's because you want to have some stimulation, you know. So that's better.
What about a book that's on the particular practice?
Well,
that's
good, but it's better if you can read it before. You have to have some prayer books. You have to be doing some
practice.
And if you have a commentary, but even the commentary can become interesting. It's better to learn it well and go in. Because you'll find yourself reading the commentary not because you want to understand the practice, but you want some kind of stimulation other than thinking, you know. And it's good.
Could you say a little bit more about Lung?
Yeah, Lung is, you know, some in the West you would call it what? Like frustration or anxiety or... It's just... It's explained as some kind of...
Maybe you call it low blood sugar. Hypoglycemia.
It's, technically speaking, it's happening in the nervous system. It consists of energy in the nervous system. And it starts to feel, it's called air, but it's not air. It's not physical air. It's a psychic air or mental air. And the symptoms of it, and you should know, because many people have a dangerous problem with it when they do long meditations. And it's, you start to feel bloated. You start to feel anxiety. Your stomach goes out a little bit, and you start to get short of breath. Your breath speeds up, and you feel like you can't breathe very smoothly. You feel a little dizzy or lightheaded. You break into giggling sometimes. Get silly with nobody around. I mean, you know, one night I was getting into this tremendous laughter about doing a. Thinking of a prank on my brother who I haven't met for a long time, you know, just starting to giggle. And what else, Carly? You know.
I think if you start thinking a lot of interesting thoughts and you start just fixing on them and then not sleeping, thinking about
not
them
sleeping
all night,
is, the, I guess, the biggest.
That's the biggest one.
The biggest, like, if you're in deep meditation and you start not sleeping, that's very bad. One person who you're supposed to communicate with is your Lama. He should be close by. At least, in necessity, you should be able to phone him if you can. Otherwise, by the way, no phone. If you can take it out, don't have it available to yourself. He should be available to help you. So it's very good if you can do a retreat near your Lama or where you can at least contact him and get his advice. Sometimes it's better to just break it and start over again later. So I think the worst sign is that you'll start not sleeping.
It's especially if you're having wonderful thoughts and realizations as a result of your meditation, and you start staying up all night thinking about those. And then what about eating the right food to try to counteract that?
Yeah, it's like heavy food.
I mean, a lot of protein and meat and onions.
Vegetarian, it's very important to eat a lot of protein, like cheeses and nuts. And sour things. But I think that depends on each person.
Yeah, I was going to say, my experience was just the opposite.
Yeah.
I was taken off oils completely because I had problems with being too sleepy.
So it might... Oh, yeah. I'm talking about when you have the opposite.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it more. We'll get to it later. Okay.
So those symptoms, like shortness of breath and can't breathe smoothly, dizzy, all of that, over what period of time?
I would say if you're really having a lousy meditation retreat, they could start happening within 2 or 3 days.
No, but how long would they go on for that to make it a concern?
Oh, I'd say if you don't sleep more than 2 days, you should stop and seek some, you know, get out and start. You know, and you say, okay, it's a good deed, I tried, and I'm not ready, and next time I'll do better. I have to do better preliminaries. And there's a time when even great heroes run from the battleground wiser. Many people have been badly hurt by that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, in hospital. You don't want to do that.
How
if you do it happy, everything just right, all the preliminaries right, it's just smooth. And you hear these stories and you say, I don't know why these people do that. You know, I think they come from... I know one case, famous case in ours, where we grew up as Dharma students, where the Lama told him not to do a certain practice, and he did it. And he went crazy. And he was in the mental hospital for a couple of days.
Temporary insanity, or?
Yeah, very temporary. He came out of it. But there was nothing to do. We had to kill him. So I think it's, you have to follow instructions. If you do, they go, I don't want to scare you. 90% go very, very smooth, very nice, very happy, blissful. I think David was telling me about some good retreats. They don't always start very good. Your back hurts for a while. You got to also tough it out sometimes.
So what is it that would cause you to go into the hospital, I mean, actually? From
too
the
much work? Noon.
I mean, but how would that cause you to go in the hospital?
No, the guy just got wild.
Not the mental hospital guy, but like a physical hospital.
Oh, I think not sleeping for a long time, and then you don't eat
If anybody deprived of sleep long enough takes on the symptoms of just like schizophrenia. It's, once they get sleep, it usually goes away right away. Air Force test.
Here's number two. Dibachalam. This is second condition. Now, this is not really part of your environment. It's more of an attitude. Dibachalam means you don't want many things. Dibha means want. Chalam means little. And it's a kind of attitude where you don't need much. I call it few needs or something. You just don't need much to be happy or to be satisfied. Its cousin, its brother, is Chokshepa. Chokshepa means it's the Tibetan word to be satisfied, easily satisfied with whatever you get. So what are the difference between the two? Dibachalam means from the beginning you don't want much. And Chokshepa means whatever you get, you feel like, okay, that's enough. Those are two different mental functions, actually. This comes from a very, very fantastic book called Abhidhamma Kosha. I remember when I was a student and I used to get frustrated by these Sanskrit words. They just went on and on and I couldn't remember. I couldn't see any difference between most of them. Sanskrit is written without any spaces. Because when one word gets close to another word, they join. And they become the joining, the two letters at the ends form a new letter. So you can't break it apart, and it's very hard to read Sanskrit for that. Abhidharma means higher knowledge. Kosha means a treasure.
This is the brother?
Yeah, I was going to trick you and ask you. I misspelled this. I think there's an H in here, but I always forget what it's here. I worked for 10 years on his book. I'll put it here.
So then the first one is from Asanga, and then these two are from Dasubandhu?
I think I misspelled. I'll check it for you. Dasubandhu is the other brother. He's Asanga's half-brother.
Were those books written in Tibetan?
No, this is in Sanskrit.
It was written in Sanskrit?
Yeah, about 600 years before Buddhism came to Tibet. And so these are by the ancient...
So all of them were written in Sanskrit?
All the books we're going to study in this five-year course started in ancient India. They are the original books of Buddhism. So Vasubandhu wrote the Abhidhamma Kosha. When do you think he lived?
Around the same time as his brother.
Okay, easy. Yeah, I have it wrong.
How was he the half brother?
Well, remember that he came. I don't remember which came
she
from married Brahman.
She married. She got around. She had around.
She had two. Be careful. She's a holy.
She's
kind of
around in the holy
way. Okay. He has a chapter. His book, the Abhidhamma Kosha. I spent 10 years translating the first time on his commentary too, and it's incredible. It's just incredible. And We'll study it someday. In the monastery, you study it just before your geshe examination. And these two principles he lists as important for meditation. Okay. So, in general, your meditation can't succeed. Once you go into that room, forget about everything else. You don't need anything else. Live without whatever you live without. Be happy with whatever you have. If you're thinking that you need one more thing to build the meditation, or you need something else, or you have any desire for anything in general, and he's talking before the meditation too, if you're a person who's hoping to get a new house, hoping for a new car, hoping for a higher position at work, not satisfied with what he has, which is a disaster. I think there was an ancient king called Nalenyu. He was a Buddha. He was the Buddha in his former life. And he said the greatest suffering in the world is that people are not happy with what they have. They always want more. Mm. And if you've seen that with your job or whatever, you know, I started my job at $7 an hour. I was very happy. And I remember every year I always thought that that wasn't enough, you know, and every year they would raise you. And then if someone asked me now, would you work for $7 an hour? You know, I would say, are you crazy, you know? But that's a result of not having chokshepa. Chokshepa means, you know, whatever I can get, fine, it's enough. I don't need more than that. You can't have a good meditation unless you really have these two thoughts, and you can't not have them up to the time you walk in the meditation place and then suddenly get them. You know? They have to start from your life, from your daily life. And they're very useful. I mean, that monk that I spoke about, Yeshe Dongden, I heard a story last night that he lives in Dharamsala in a cave, and somebody he always walks around with his robes up to here, and he looks like a dork. And I saw him in the port authority on the way here last week. And he just looks goofy, you know? And I found out he does it on purpose. He doesn't want to be proud. So he wears his robes like, he looks funny. And somebody gave him a new robes, and he burned them. And because he doesn't want to be tempted by it, you know, and he purposely doesn't give himself anything to be tempted about. So that's Dhruva Chama Choshe. It doesn't mean to go to work sloppy and purposely don't iron your shirt or something. If you're going to work and you have the right, you need to have Yanda Pitsala. According to Buddhism, you need to support yourself and not grub off other people. And you've got to stand on your own two feet and not bother other people. So you should have a job. It should be a nice job. You don't have to do anything wrong. You should look neat and nice, and you should do okay. That doesn't mean that. But it means be satisfied with that. Don't go to Macy's if you can go to, what's the other one? Someplace
Salvation Army.
Could you just say what the difference is?
Yeah, again, they're kind of hard to distinguish. Dhruva Chungwa means not wanting many things. And Chokshepa means being satisfied with whatever you get. It's not quite the same. Dhruva Chungwa means from the beginning you don't need much. And Chokshepa means whatever you get, no matter how lousy it is, okay, that's enough. That's enough.
Does this apply only to worldly things, or what about your like hunger for the Dharma? Are you supposed to sort of be satisfied with?
No. No, you're supposed to be thirstless.
But also not attached. You got to be willing to let go with whatever you can get.
It's dangerous to be attached. But I remember when I went to New Jersey 20 years ago, and this old monk, blind monk, and there's this other student there named Art, who's a great scholar, and he says, "Very good, you have Art." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, you'd be jealous of him. And you'll compete with each other in your Dhamma studies. And you'll push each other." And then later you give up the jealousy, okay? So, I mean, he's joking, but, I mean, you can use your, you know, it's not, Dhruva is a difficult word. Tanda means a desire for freedom, desire for liberation. Westerners hear this idea of no desire, and they think you're not supposed to want anything, even nirvana or Buddhahood. That's not correct. That's totally wrong. Dhruva is okay. You're supposed to want Buddhahood. What's the definition of bodhicitta? Desire.
What?
To want Buddhahood for the sake of Buddha. That's the definition by a Sangha of bodhicitta. And we had it. The other people memorized it. it's a kind of desire, but it's a good desire. And we'll talk about it someday. There's a definition of this bad desire. We'll take a break, I think. And what time is it?
Just about 10 minutes.
Eight? Okay, good. So take a 10-minute break. Actually, no, I'll do something else. Velma, can you light those two? They take a while. And you need to use a lighter. The gas thing doesn't work. And you're probably going to use it. There's a lighter up in your aerial.
Conditions.
And then let's do one more thing, and then it'll heat up in the meantime.
Characteristics.
So I'm getting the impression if you go into a retreat with sort of the idea of, well, I'll read some Dharma books while I'm there and I'll walk around outside.
Well, there are study retreats.
No, I'm talking like a single point of concentration retreat.
I mean, you're allowed to take books into retreat. And we'll see. We'll talk about it here. It'll be here. But in Buddhism, there are what are called the inner sciences and the outer sciences.
Yeah.
The other sciences are like medicine, Buddhist medicine, and Buddhist astrology, Buddhist painting, Buddhist sculpture. The fine arts are considered lesser sciences. And then there are the Buddhist sciences, the religious sciences, spiritual sciences. And it's considered very bad in a retreat to do the lower sciences. You see? And it's even considered bad to study them until you finish them. It's very good, you know, especially if you're a Westerner and you haven't studied these books a lot.
Yeah.
It's very good to have the instructions with you because you run into problems and you want to refer to something. That's fine.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, beware, speaking from experience, your mind will grasp on, you know, to this activity. It's nothing it can do.
Yeah. I was thinking, it's, you know, somebody went into a retreat, you know, for whatever, 6 months or 9 months, and they wanted to attain calm abiding.
Yeah.
You know, and they, you know, had a wide perimeter, and they walked around outside and looked at the creatures running around on the ground and looked at the...
I don't think they could do it, or it would be difficult.
Yeah.
And I can say that the opposite works very well.
What do you mean?
Total isolation.
Michael, the retreat that Genlong Rinpoche led in Seattle, the one-year Shamatha retreat, almost everybody in that retreat did go outside, did go down to the dining hall for lunch and dinner and meals, didn't talk, but availed themselves of the outdoors. And there was one person who really stayed in her room.